Hello, friends. A Little Woman 1949. This was one of those versions of Little Woman that I did not see until I was an adult. But before we get into that, today's comment shoutout goes to Fandoms Are Family 1966, who sent this question to me on Tumblr. Genuine question. Why do so many people talk about Meg like she is vain? Like, how is wanting nice things and wanting to fit in vain? I can understand people saying that about Amy, especially when she was a kid. But Meg is the sweetest of the four sisters, next to Beth. And isn't vanity being too self-important? Am I missing something? Sorry for all the questions, but I just do not understand. And here is my answer. I have often wondered this myself. I wonder if it has something to do with Meg being more of a feminine type of girl, and people attack her simply because she likes to be girlish, and femininity is often connected with vanity. I don't know. In the book, like you said, Meg is not really a vain person. The whole Vanity Fair chapter is really more about self-discovery, and Meg is thinking about her own self-worth. These other rich girls, they treat her like she is a doll, and they play dress-up games with her. In the end, Meg even said she could not recognize herself anymore. The 2019 film completely missed the point on this. Once again, Gerwig said that, quote, Meg needs a day off from her terrible, miserable life. Meg in the book never thinks that her life is terrible. Yes, she is poor, but in the end of the Vanity Fair chapter, it feels more like I would not change my life for the lives of these girls. It is so hollow. If the person only watches the 2019 film and takes that narration, no wonder people think that Meg is a vain person. I also think it is really hypocritical sometimes the way Meg gets criticized when she buys the silk for a dress. She was very poor and getting luxury items was pretty rare for her. That is not something a poor girl should be condemned. If we think about Laurie, he is written to be very dandy, a nice-looking young man who likes to take care of his appearance. Joe even criticizes how he buys expensive gloves and perfumes and whatnots. Nobody ever criticizes Laurie for that. Total double standards. Also, Laurie was a metrosexual before metrosexuality was a thing. End quote. Then my pal Annabelle also left a comment about this topic, which was very enlightening. You know that trope, real women don't wear dresses? That trope is pretty sexist, considering how it represents to be a girl is to act as much like a boy as possible. Nothing wrong with being like that, just don't belittle other girls who aren't like that. Speaking as someone who never saw the 2019 movie, Meg was never unhappy with her life. Sure, she didn't exactly like working sometimes, but we all have days where we hate our jobs. And she has a family who loves her, even if she and her sister squabble sometimes. That is just life with siblings. Also, I never noticed that about Laurie before. He was totally a dandy, lol. Maybe because it is not too emphasized in the movies. Except maybe at parties when you are usually supposed to dress up. That no one reading the books calls Laurie out for it. But still, God forbid, Meg has an impulse buy one time and almost immediately gets a refund when she realizes what she has done. End quote. And here's a final comment from My Great Adventures Has Begun. Honestly, the only thing Meg was ever vain about were her hands. She knew she had pretty hands and was worried about Joe stretching her gloves, which were like treasures to her at the start of the story. That was a full-blown conversation, and the conclusion is Meg was never a vain person. I wanted to say something about the 1949 Meg. I love Janet Leigh as Meg. I think she is a little different to other Megs. She's a little snarky. There are a couple of times in the movie when Joe does some of her more boyish things, habits, and Meg makes some snarky comments about them. It is quite funny, and it reminds me of the book Meg. She has a very good sense of humor. Some adaptations bring that up more than others. If you guys wish to get notified when new videos are being posted, you can join my email list. It is completely free. You can join at littlewomanpodcast.substack.com. And if you want to read more about my Little Woman research and find episode transcripts, you can visit my Gumroad site at littlewoman.gumroad.com. This is Little Woman Podcast, Anatomy of a Movie, Little Woman 1949.
...1949, which has almost the exact script as the 1933 one, but with changes, is kind of funny. I am curious to know why they felt the need to recycle the script. Quite a bit of it is pretty much the same, but they obviously made some changes by rearranging a few scenes. I think I like the 1949 just a little bit better. I don't know if is it because of the switching around of the certain scenes that work or some added scenes. But I feel like I like it a little bit better. How about you?
Yes, there are things that I really like about it. I recently watched three other films by Rossano Brassi, and I have to say, the man can sing. Two of those were musicals, so definitely. I was just thinking how in the book, Joe and Friedrich, they do sing together when they meet a couple of times. It is actually quite nice that he is singing in this movie.
It is sort of funny. I haven't seen the movie, but I have seen it pop on my recommendations. He did a movie with Katharine Hepburn, so it's like, it is Friedrich and Joe getting together. Summertime?
Yes, that is the name of it. Summertime. You know, I saw that film, the one with Katharine Hepburn. It did have Joe and Friedrich vibes. Katharine Hepburn's character, she didn't think that she was worthy of finding someone who could love her.
I think the script is very similar to the 1933 one, but I do want to point out a scene that you and I have at some point talked about, and we both really love the interpretation. When Friedrich talks to her about her writing, we feel like the scene that is done in the 1949 one feels a lot closer to the book. And personally, I think it is because they had Joe add the line, "Oh, I don't think these are any good, but they help pay a new coat for Beth and take her to the sea," and Friedrich being like, "Oh, that is what I figured." And I think some versions forget that. I feel like that is probably one of the reasons why I really like the scene, because not only, as we see in the 1933 one, is he saying, "I know you have talent," but having Joe say that line too brings it closer to the book and its feeling.
I think it is the same with some portrayals of Amy. If the script writer does not really like Friedrich's character, they make him and Joe argue, which does not happen in the book. But that is not the case in this movie, because he gives her encouraging feedback. You can do better. I think you are a great writer and you can do better than this stuff you are writing at the moment. And that is the way he is in the book.
This version had a little bit more of Joe and Friedrich than the 33 one. I think that is because, again, they switched around a few scenes and added a little bit. But I think if I had to think about nuances in the adaptation that treat Friedrich fairly, this is one of those. How about the actors? How did you feel? Because this is a pretty star-studded film compared to the 33.
I think in the 1949 film, a lot of the actors are more handsome and more beautiful than they are written to be in the book. I would say all the male characters, Laurie, Friedrich, and John, and even Joe's father, they are all very good-looking actors, all these men. There's Hollywood for you.
I still think that there is that feeling of, to the characters, Peter Lawford is not my personal favorite Laurie's. I don't hate him. I don't know if, is it because I think he is a little more subdued than I think compared to Douglas Montgomery or some of the later Laurie's.
Maybe more masculine?
Yeah, I really do like June Allyson.
She has often played this girl of the next door type. Not as stunning beauty compared to some like Janet Leigh or Elizabeth Taylor, but you still go. Oh, you are very pretty. There is a point in the book where you wonder if is Jo a lot prettier than she says.
Someone makes a comment and she is like, they are just lying. There is no way I am that pretty, as they say. She still manages to have that same talent that Katharine Hepburn has, tomboyish and childish manner, but then slowly growing into the mature young lady. Still with some spirit, but I think she did a pretty good job.
It also shows that Jo has this maternal nature. I think this is one of the rare adaptations where Jo interacts with children very actively.
Yeah, there is one of the added scenes in this one. We actually see her with Kitty and Minnie. Now I am just thinking of that moment with Friedrich after the opera. They get interrupted by one of the little girls and she is like, you need to be back in bed. No story time. We have seen earlier that the story time where the girl is like, oh, read me a story. And I think this version has switched Beth and Amy, where Beth is the youngest now. It definitely shows that she is definitely mature towards Beth as well. I rather that you have the switch of making Beth the youngest and Amy the older one than if your actresses are not fitting age-wise. Elizabeth Taylor, who was 15 or 16 at that time, and Margaret O'Brien, who was 12, there is no way you are going to convince me that Margaret O'Brien is older than her. I can at least appreciate that in terms of casting.
I read that June Allison was good friends with Margaret O'Brien. They had nice chemistry together.
I have to share this because I think it is a funny story. June Allison was well known in the business being one of the best criers, and Margaret O'Brien is kind of up there. I can't remember if it was this movie or another movie. There were a lot of awful rumors because there was a documentary about her and a few other child stars of that time that
they had sometimes worked together or been in the business together at some point, and one of them was like, I heard some really nasty things about your mom.
That she makes you cry by hurting you. And she was like, no, but that is one of the things that does make me cry. Oh, honey, I think you are doing a good job, but they don't think you are doing it as great. We can put on fake tears and that is fine. But, you know, June Allison is a great crier. And Margaret O'Brien was like, I am not going to be outcried by June Allison. And that is how she began to cry, because Margaret O'Brien thought, I will be the best crier on Hollywood.
One of the complaints that I have about this station is that it doesn't have a single scene with Laurie and Amy together.
Yeah. The closest that we get to their relationship is the scene where Amy says to Jo, how would you feel if Laurie had feelings for another person? And Jo essentially gives her blessing that Laurie can go and be with another woman. Then we get right to the end where Laurie is like, oh yeah, Amy and I are married. Oh, okay.
It is a shame because I have seen these promotional pictures with Elizabeth Taylor and Peter Lawford. They look so good together. And why didn't I get a scene with them? It's really sad.
I think I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah, there are quite a few of them. At least in the 1933, we get one where Amy's mourning bed. And then she's like, Laurie, you came. And because he goes right to her and she runs into his arms. There is some of that, at least. But not too many in the 1949 film. Sometimes I wonder if this was something that started another wave of people shipping Jo and Laurie. Because in the end, right before Friedrich comes, there's this moment when Laurie is giving Jo this long, loving look. Amy is standing right next to him, but he's looking at Jo, and then suddenly Friedrich comes, and then it goes under the umbrella. That is really confusing. The same happens in the 2019 film, with Jo suddenly wanting Laurie back, which is not in the book. So we haven't moved on anywhere.
It is such an awkward shot, because we literally just come from the attic scene where he is like, Amy and I are so happy, then going into that loving look of longing. I don't want to say total regret, but I can see why some people would think, oh, poor Amy, what ending she got. This version does not tell you everything about Amy and Laurie's progression that I think is a point taken away from the film.
I wonder if it is the editor's fault or was it the script? I don't know. Then there is the scene where Laurie proposes to Joe and he's pretty angry, which is good because that is in the book. Right after he walks away, there's a scene that lasts for a second where Amy is looking after him. And you might miss it if you don't pay attention to it. It is a confusing narrative.
Again, it is weird because pretty much you can do almost a side-by-side comparison with the 33 film, and it is almost exact. Certain scenes are added, like their discussion with Laurie in the beginning. There is a little bit more, oh, he ran away and this, but I am surprised that certain scenes go out because it is not even long. That one scene in Europe with Amy and Laurie reuniting, that is probably not more than 30 seconds. It's a near minute. Why wasn't that minute so important to them?
It is so confusing.
This one is not a good Amy and Laurie film. It is Joe and Friedrich friendly, but not Amy and Laurie friendly.
You know, I read Elizabeth Taylor's biography and I was very excited when I got into Little Woman, and it was only then she played spoiled Amy in the 1949 Little Woman. That was the only thing the book mentioned, and I'm like, this is not good. But to be fair, that book handled more about her marriages than her acting career.
I was going to say, unfortunately, her private life did overshadow her career quite a bit.
Elizabeth Taylor was an amazing actress.
I think she did this part really well between her acting and the script. Joe and her younger Amy, we see her being a little snobbish, childish type of girl. But when we get to see her later, we see that she is very mature and fully adult. I think she did that pretty well, if I remember correctly. I think she pretty much jumped from being a child actress to being an adult actress. I want to say that when she was 15, she worked on a movie where her co-star was like 10 years older than her, and they were acting as a married couple of the same age. She just looked very mature. When I looked at her, I would have thought her to be at least 20, but no, she was 15. This was probably one of the rare films where she got to play the natural progression of her age from teenager to adult in terms of how she portrayed the character rather than just being a full-on adult. She managed to do it well.
I do like that scene when Aunt March and Amy go to New York to meet Joe, and then they tell Joe that they are going to Europe. And then Amy feels really bad that Joe did not get the trip. That is somewhat closer to the books. It is not like in some other adaptations where Amy is like, why nobody can be happy for me?
I think this is one of those ones where it didn't feel like they were constantly pitting Joe and Amy against each other. I do feel like some versions really push that, and this one takes a better progression. We see them butting heads because Amy is complaining about the play and Joe is trying to tell her no. But now that they are adults, they actually talk to each other and it is very clear that they do love each other. They just are sisters, and sisters just get on each other's nerves sometimes.
I think it is important that you see that. It is not like the other one is more mature than the other. They grow at the same pace. A lot of times people are like, Joe stayed as a child while Amy grew, or Amy stayed as a child while Joe became an adult, when they both grow as people in the novel.
Margaret O'Brien is probably one of my top three favorite Beths. I think she did a wonderful job.
I really like her relationship with older Mr. Lawrence in this movie. It is very moving.
Two scenes that really stand out to me. The first one is when she comes home from the Hummels, and her standing there, you can feel that the death of that baby really affected her. She is just standing there almost stunned. I always remember that scene because I'm just like, how do you process that? It really did feel like, poor Beth. It is very sensitive. The baby died in my arms, and now I am sick. I think it really showed that, Beth, you had a lot of trauma going on there. Somebody else would have totally broken down, but you are a lot stronger emotionally than I think people give you credit for. Physically, obviously, we know she is very weak, but emotionally, spiritually, she was definitely very strong. And then the other moment is her scene with Joe saying, I know I am dying, but I can accept that. I need you to accept it too. I always get teary-eyed when I watch it because it is so emotional. I think too, because when I look at them, it's like, look at this little girl comforting her older sister. It is okay, Joe. I am going to die, but you have so much life to live.
I think a lot of the modern feminist narrative about Beth is one-sided and very offensive to her character. If you are 15 and you see a child dying literally in your arms, it doesn't matter if it was the 1850s or 2024, that is going to traumatize you a lot.
Especially if you have never been in a situation where death has been prominent. They were fairly young when Aunt March's husband passed away. I don't think they were that acquainted with the idea compared to a few other people. The idea of a baby dying, a life that could have lived for so much more and dying in your arms. At some point in the book, Beth says, I felt the baby grow cold. For some people, that I will never forget that feeling. It is not just like, oh, you were cold because you stayed under weather. You were cold because there is no life. That is a lot to process. Later on that day, oh yeah, scarlet fever. I could be dying next. Even though she wasn't physically strong, people are like, oh yeah, she is just there to give sympathy to the characters. She has to deal with that all on her own. The second time she realized that she was really sick and going to die. That is a lot more baggage than I think people want to give her. They're like, no, she is just the martyr sister and she's there to die. No.
Absolutely. It always makes me angry when I read stuff like that, because then it is like you completely miss the point. Maybe they don't read the book. I think that is the case. Aunt March in this movie is hilarious.
She cracks me up. I did like the other Aunt March, but this one really did crack me up because she is a very good grudge. Old lady, but humorous type.
Lucille Watson. Very demanding presence.
I was just thinking of that scene where she comes in to give Marmee the money and you can see Amy just shrinks away. Just her presence is enough for you to feel like, oh no.
Then there is the moment when John comes to tell Meg that he is in love with her, but Aunt March settles the question. I watched this movie first time maybe 5 years ago. I was really surprised by that scene because I remember that it was in the book, but I hadn't seen that in any other adaptations except this one and the 1933 one. And it was a nice thing to see. John actually forgets his umbrella to the marches, so it is a bit like Friedrich with the umbrella. Then he comes back for it, and then he hears Meg defending him to Aunt March. It is so cute.
I need to mention that in the 33 one, I really like the little scene between them, because I think in the 33 one, when John comes, he is like, I came to get my umbrella. I also wanted to see how you are and to talk with your dad. Meg goes, oh, he is in the rack. I mean, your umbrella is quite well. He messes things up because she is so nervous.
That is so cute.
Yes, they are really cute. I like to see their own little moments when they are walking together and the conservatory scene. Oh, I am so sorry that you don't have any family to worry about, but we will. And John is like, would you? And he is looking her to her eyes. There are quite a few moments. There are a lot more moments between John and Meg in those movies than I remembered.
That is definitely a plus.
Overall, if you had to place the 49 one, where would you put it? And again, we can shift movies too if we feel like it.
I think it is going to be my third one now.
Third one, and you put 33 number two.
Yeah.
I am thinking the same thing too. Again, as the funny it is that the scripts are pretty much the same, they managed to switch it up a bit.
I don't know if you remember this, but in the 1949 film, there's the moment when the maid in New York says, "Oh, professor, he's from Germany and he teaches languages, but why do they need to learn languages when they all live right here?"
Oh, yeah. She wasn't that active. I remember that because as soon as Friedrich came in, she became alive. She is dragging Joe along and Joe is trying to talk to her and she is like, aha. And then as soon as Friedrich comes in, she is all chattery. I do remember that. That actress has a great voice. I think it adds to the funniness. Her voice is like a higher pitched New Yorker. It is funny compared to her visual appearance, just being like, hey, another day, another hour closer to death. That is a good moment.
It is also nice in the film when Joe is in New York. You do get this feeling that Friedrich is looking after her. He's taking her to different places. He takes her to the zoo, to the circus, and to the opera. You get this feeling that when Joe lived in Concord, she didn't have that many places where she could go. When she is in New York, Friedrich is this cultivated guide for her who shows her the world. I like that.
When she is like, oh, I think I want to be a singer, and he says before you wanted to be a tightrope walker, he is more amused and not like just pick one. He is enthralled by her enthusiasm about the world. I did like that.
You do get this sense that he's really amazed by her, or that he has this deep crush on her. When I was watching these other Rossano Brassi films, he's very attentive with the female actresses. Maybe it was just the actor's personality, but in this case, it really works because that is how Friedrich is in the book with Joe. It just melts my heart.
He just understood exactly what the character was. He was like, oh, this guy is in love with this woman and is romantic. Well, I can do that.
That is the way Friedrich is. He's supposed to be in love with Joe, but not show that directly to her when they are in New York. He's very careful and respectful around her, which is opposite to Laurie.
I remember in the 49-1, because it switches around the scenes of Joe and Friedrich from the 33 film, where they had the discussion about her writing before they go to the opera, whereas in the 49-1, that discussion happens after. When he tries to tell her how he feels, I just feel it because it feels like he is finally ready to say something, but then it's like, oh no. And then when you get to the end of him coming to the house and he hears Lori's name, Joe is calling for Lori. He thinks that they are together with much grace and dignity. He gives Joe the book and essentially thinks I'm too late, but I want her to be happy. Again, that is a strong opposite to Lori's reaction, but this one definitely made me go, oh, poor Friedrich. But then I was like, good, he loves Joe and they can actually be together. That is a great scene with Under the Umbrella. I think this one is one of the top versions of Joe and Friedrich. If you are really there just for Joe and Friedrich, this film will give you that.
No wonder I fell in love with this film when I saw it for the first time. It is not the only reason why I like this version, but it does play a big part. That was the discussion between Christina and myself. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I will see you next time. Take care and make good choices. Bye. Thank you so much for listening. Christina and I continue our chat next time. Take care and make good choices. Bye.